Power and light. I'm going to explore this theme from a couple of perspectives this morning. And I want to begin with a t-shirt worn by the UN Youth Envoy as she introduced the Youth Climate Summit yesterday in New York City. There is no planet B. There is no planet B. That's what her t-shirt said. On Friday, I took my two daughters out of school so they could join the climate strike that was going on around the world. Anybody else participate? Tomorrow is the first day of fall. It's also the launch of the United Nations Climate Summit. And Thursday is the International Day for the Total Elimination of Nuclear Weapons. We stand today on the cusp of summer and fall, a time for changing of seasons, a time of turning. And I'd like to invite us into a time of reflection on our own lives and how we may, in this time of change and of turning, make changes in our own behavior, in our own activity. I'll start with a disclosure of where I stand on the issue of climate change. I believe the planet is warming at an alarming rate. I believe that warming is caused by human activity. And I believe that this warming, left unchecked, will lead us on a dangerous and unsustainable path toward the disruption in the Earth's climate. I also agree with Al Gore, who said in an opinion piece published on Friday in the New York Times that the climate crisis is the battle of our times, and we can win. We can win. That was the message from Al Gore, and I agree with that message of hope. We need to win. I've arrived at my position where I stand by engaging, among other sources, our principles and purposes, our commitment to justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, our commitment to a free and responsible search for truth and meaning, a commitment to heed the findings of science. I believe that Al Gore's message is a message of hope, and I do have hope. This was also the message brought by Greta Thunberg, the 16-year-old Swede who sailed across the Atlantic to attend the climate summit here in New York. She said recently, "We do need hope, of course we do, but one thing we need more than hope is action. And once we start to act, hope is everywhere." So how ought we to act? What kind of human activity is causing global warming, and what kind of human activity will cause global warming going forward? And how might we, in our daily choices, down to the choices of what we eat for breakfast, and even what kind of refrigerator we buy, how might those choices better reflect our values and our aspirations? In May, during my sabbatical, I rode my bike from Philadelphia to Washington, D.C. I didn't go alone. I went with a group of clergy organized by Interfaith Power and Light. Interfaith Power and Light, I'll just read their mission statement here, is a community of congregations, faith-based organizations, and individuals of faith responding to climate change as an ethical and moral issue through advocacy, education, energy conservation, energy efficiency, stewardship, and the use and promotion of clean, renewable energy. Now, I know this issue matters to this community. I know there's a Green Sanctuary ministry that's alive and beginning to find new energy here. I know that recently a number of you signed on to a solar co-op, and I celebrate that, I applaud that. Beyond this congregation, our denomination, the Unitarian Universalist Association, has a long commitment to climate justice. In 2006, at our General Assembly, we passed a statement of conscience on climate justice. If you haven't seen it, it's a great source to look towards as you discern your own stand on this emerging issue. So I got on my bike, encouraged, even pressured maybe by a colleague who is a Unitarian minister and the executive director of Pennsylvania Interfaith Power and Light. And I want to share with you my journal entry from the first day of the ride. I left my home by bike this morning, and when we arrived at our destination in Delaware, my odometer read 51.7 miles. On the ride, contrasts were stark. We rode past sun-basking turtles, enjoying refuge at the John Hines National Wildlife Preserve. We rode under lush green canopies along the Northern Delaware Greenway Trail. And in between, we rode along bustling highways as tractor trailers and garbage trucks rumbled past, moving from wildlife refuge to wildlife roadkill. I found myself evading the crushed snakes and maimed raccoons that littered the breakdown lane. The roadkill was a visceral reminder to me of the impact of U.S. oil and car addiction on the animals who share this planet with us. Some miles we breathed fresh air, many miles we breathed bad air. The smell of roadside death mixed with emissions from vehicles and industry. Then there was Post Road, on which we traveled out of southern Pennsylvania into Delaware. Post Road might better be called Not in My Backyard, NIMBY Road. Along that stretch, I witnessed some of the infrastructure and industry necessary to sustain high carbon lifestyles. We passed the sprawling refinery run by Monroe Energy. We passed the massive complex run by Boeing, a major U.S. defense contractor. And we passed Honeywell, the largest U.S. defense contractor for nuclear weapons. As I rode past Boeing and Honeywell, I thought about U.S. defense expenditures, which an annual sum greater than the next five largest national defense expenditures combined. I thought about the $100,000 a minute the U.S. is spending and will continue to spend over the next decade on nuclear weapons modernization. I thought about my own time as a military chaplain deployed to the Middle East and the words a colleague of mine shared with me who had been to Iraq. We were there to protect and defend Halliburton. Also, along Post Road, we passed Calvary Baptist Church and a historic marker. I quote, "Martin Luther King Jr. lived 3 years in this community and ministered under the mentorship of J. Pius Barber. He graduated from Crozier Theological Seminary in 1951, a leader of the 1963 March on Washington. King won a Nobel Peace Prize, 1964. After spotting the historic marker, I began to pay more attention to race on the ride. I am white, and our group of riders was mostly white, but I noticed the people living along Post Road, the people breathing the bad air from their front porches, from their playgrounds, from their childcare facilities. They were black. And I was reminded of the intersectionality of climate justice and racial justice. I was reminded that those who pay the cost of high carbon living are often the most marginalized and disenfranchised. They include among others, the rice farmers in places like Indonesia. Well, about a month after I rode my bike through the Monroe Refinery in southern Philadelphia, on June 21st at about 4 o'clock in the morning, an alarm sounded. There was a leak in Unit 433, one of the units that uses highly toxic hydrofluoric acid. Then the unit exploded twice. It was still an hour till sunrise, yet, as one first responder put it, it looked like somebody turned a light switch on in the sky. The fire was so intense, it was picked up by orbiting weather satellites. Soon, the Philadelphia Fire Department had about 51 trucks and 120 people on the site, and residents were told to shelter in place. Had there been a major accidental release, it would have sent a dangerous cloud of hydrogen fluoride drifting over the entire South Philadelphia community, causing mass contamination and almost instant death for those in the immediate vicinity. By some grace, Philadelphia was spared this catastrophe. My experience on the ride and reflecting on the refinery explosion that was not in my backyard reminds me of a painful truth, that my privileged location shields me, enables me to deny the worst consequences of my activity. Yet, people of color, often poor people, are disproportionately affected. Here we need to acknowledge what King called the triplets of evil: militarism, racism, and economic injustice. Another way of describing this idea of intersectionality. I've had glimpses of the way these triple evils unfold in the lives of people of color in South Philadelphia and beyond. In December of 2016, in the midst of the Dakota Access Pipeline protests, I visited Standing Rock Sioux Tribe Reservation in the Dakotas. I went in response to the call to clergy put out by Chief Arvo Looking Horse, the 19th keeper of the sacred bundle and the spiritual leader of the Lakota, Dakota, and Nakota people. The pipeline has continued through that reservation despite the protests and despite our best efforts. Militarism has had its effects often beyond our borders, out of sight and out of mind. The Souls of Poor Folk in April 2018 report on the conditions and trends of poverty in the United States reports that U.S. military operations accounted for 72% of the U.S. government's total greenhouse gas emissions in 2016. 72%. And those greenhouse gas emissions are just the beginning. A forthcoming study in the journal Environmental Pollution, researchers report that Iraqi children are now testing positive for depleted uranium remnants near former U.S. air bases in Iraq. As much as 200 metric tons of depleted uranium entered Iraq in 2003, mostly from the thousands of rounds fired by U.S. forces. The bodies of children born with congenital disabilities, such as heart disease and malformed limbs, near Talil Air Base in southern Iraq, are contaminated with high levels of radioactive heavy metals. Well, what can one person do? Given the looming threats of climate change and nuclear annihilation through catastrophic war, it's easy to slide into despair. But I began my message this morning with hope, and I do have hope, and we need that hope. The hope for me comes, and this is my Hiroshima peace stole. I decided to wear it today. It was given to me by the Hibakusha in Hiroshima when I visited in 2015. So it comes down to the question of what can I do? Well, we need to understand the sources of carbon in our own lives. So I'll break it down. For the average U.S. citizen, transportation amounts for about 28%, followed by the stuff you buy, 26%, home heating and cooling, 17%, other home energy use, including your refrigerator, 15%, and then food at 14%. And all these emissions add up. On average, each of us, as a citizen of the U.S., causes more than 20 tons of carbon dioxide to be emitted into the atmosphere annually, more than four times the global person average annually, and more than twice the amount per person in most industrialized countries. This is a concerning statistic for those of us committed to justice. We are not emitting our fair share of carbon, four times that of most of the world. Well, in the book, We Are the Weather, Saving the Planet Begins at Breakfast, the author, Jonathan Foer, makes the case that for us in the United States and citizens of other voracious meat-eating countries, consuming fewer animal products is the most important single thing we can do. Now, there are other arguments against this. The range of estimates of what food production contributes towards carbon emissions goes anywhere from 7% at the low end to about 50% at the high end. So there's a lot of debate around this. But what is not debatable is that eating meat contributes to climate change. And industrial agriculture uses most of the fertile land to grow corn and soybeans to feed livestock, not people, and also to form the basis of our ultra-processed food. So there are choices that begin at breakfast, and the author of We Are the Weather suggests no meat products before dinner as a first step. This book from the Union of Concerned Scientists has been a useful reference for me. It's called Cooler, Smarter, Practical Steps for Low Carbon Living. And the authors challenge us to reduce our carbon footprint by 20% in the next year, in our own individual lives. They recommend a series of steps. Many of them I've undertaken in my own life. Riding your bike instead of driving. Increasing the home energy efficiency of your home. But the struggle for climate justice has a spiritual and even a soul dimension. Foer, in his book, We Are the Weather, has a chapter called Disputes with the Soul. And in it, he talks about human nature. He says, because of our human nature, people like me who should care and should be motivated and should make big changes find it almost impossible to make small sacrifices for profound future benefit. What is it about us critters that makes it so hard for us to change? Gus Speth, who was the former dean of the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies at Yale, once made these remarks. He says, "I used to think the top environmental problems were biodiversity loss, ecosystem collapse, and climate change. But I was wrong. The top environmental problems are selfishness, greed, and apathy." It's that bubble that somebody mentioned that we live in this morning. Gus Speth said that to deal with those issues, we need a spiritual and cultural transformation. And we scientists don't know how to do that. Who are then the ones to lead a spiritual and cultural transformation? Well, this, my friends, I believe is ours to do. That we are the ones. The transformation begins with the one human activity we have the most control over, my own activity, and the activity of the groups to which we belong, including this congregation, the denomination that this congregation is in association with. It also includes the towns and states in which we hold residency. The strategy of Interfaith Power and Light is to organize at the state level. So while I rode my bike with Pennsylvania Interfaith Power and Light, there's also a New York State Interfaith Power and Light, and there's a rabbi who directs it. And this congregation is one of 120 congregations that is a member of New York Interfaith Power and Light. Did you know that? So our influence includes the towns and states in which we hold residency and also the nation in which we hold citizenship. How we vote in the next election matters. And the Green New Deal has been endorsed by some of the candidates. Many of the candidates have ambitious proposals to become carbon neutral in the United States in the near future. I'll close just briefly mentioning, on Thursday, I was at the Perry House at the University of Pennsylvania. There was a conference on no first use. It was about nuclear weapons and the treaty that has gone through the United Nations banning nuclear weapons, been endorsed by 70 nations already. I heard for the first time Elaine Scarry speak, and actually her message was about like her name. It was a scary message. Elaine Scarry teaches at Harvard, and she just published a book called Thermonuclear Monarchy, Choosing Between Democracy and Doom. It's a thick book, but let me give you the summary of it. And this, because Thursday is International Day for the Total Abolition of Nuclear Weapons, we need to think about what might happen and how that might impact climate. And what I mean is nuclear winter, the catastrophic humanitarian and ecological consequence of a nuclear exchange. So Elaine Scarry, in her scary book, Thermonuclear Monarchy, says there are two phenomena that are happening that we need to understand. On the one hand, we have this massive expansion of capacity for destruction on an international scale. And you know, we're talking about 13,880 nuclear warheads stretched across nine nations. And she presented it, I tried to do the math, I don't have any reason to doubt her, but Elaine said, if we, as humans, deployed only 0.01% of this arsenal, 44 million people would die in the first afternoon and 1 billion in the first month. either from the direct impact of the bomb or the mass ecological devastation, which has been now termed nuclear winter. So we have that on the one hand, this expansion, destruction, capacity, and that's the realm, she says, of international law needs to focus and rein that in. Then on the other hand, we have this consolidation of power into one person, the President of the United States, the Presidential Launch Authority. And she calls, therefore, nuclear weapons ungovernable and incompatible with governance because we have one person with the sole launch authority to unleash all of that destruction. And that launch can be launched in the length of a tweet. So coming back to what can I do, what should I do, how ought I respond? House Resolution 669, the Markley Liu in the House, but also now a Senate parallel initiative, the Warren Smith Act, No First Use Act. This is something we can do as citizens to move these acts through the House, through the Senate. And even though six representatives from New York have endorsed House Resolution 669, none of the representatives from your communities have. That would be something to make a call about, or maybe even a visit. So when it comes to the theme of power and light, well, we need it for our refrigerators. We need it to light our sanctuaries. We can abuse it, the power of a nuclear blast, the light that will turn people into shadows burned into cement, as they did in Hiroshima. But the power and light that perhaps is the most important is the power and light that we have. If we are the weather, then we are also the power, and we are the light. And that, my friends, is a great responsibility and opportunity. And how we use our power and how we use our light . Well, that's where I have hope.